Hello, everyone. Good morning. You may want to take a minute to open your Bibles to chapter 18 of Exodus, which we'll read in a minute or two. A winter's day in a deep and dark December. I am alone, gazing from my window to the streets below on a freshly fallen silent shroud of snow. I am a rock. I am an island. I've built walls, a fortress steep and mighty that none may penetrate. I have no need for friendship. Friendship causes pain. It's laughter and loving I disdain. I am a rock. I am an island. Don't talk of love. I've heard the words before. It's sleeping in my memory. I won't disturb slumber of feelings that have died. If I'd never loved, I never would have cried. I'm a rock. I'm an island. I have my books and my poetry to protect me. I'm shielded in my armor, hiding in my room, safe within my womb. I touch no one, and no one touches me. I am a rock. I am an island. And a rock feels no pain. And an island never cries. Paul Simon is one of the 20th century's important poets. This particular song that I've just read must be one of the most determined laments ever written about relational pain. It vocalizes what so many of us can feel, maybe have felt. And that is that relationships can hurt us so badly that it seems far better to avoid them altogether. To retreat into our castle fortresses, pull up the drawbridge, form a crust, become a rock island. Don't let anyone in, at least then you can't get hurt. Because a rock feels no pain, and an island never cries. Paul Simon isn't the only one to have ever written about relationships. In fact, the Bible speaks about relationships a lot. And today's passage in Exodus 18 illustrates just how helpful one particular relationship was for Moses. Would you like to read together? And if you're able and willing to stand with me as I read, that would be great. Exodus chapter 18. Now Jethro, the priest of Midian, the father-in-law of Moses, heard of everything God had done for Moses and for his people, Israel, and how the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. After Moses had sent away his wife Zipporah, his father-in-law Jethro received her and her two sons. One son was named Gershom, for Moses said, "I have become an alien in a foreign land." And the other was named Eliezer, for he said, "My father's God was my helper. He saved me from the sword of Pharaoh." Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, together with Moses' sons and wife, came to him in the desert where he was camped near the mountain of God. Jethro had sent word to him, "I, your father-in-law Jethro, am coming to you with your wife and her two sons." So Moses went out to meet his father-in-law and bowed down and kissed him. They greeted each other and then went into the tent. Moses told his father-in-law about everything the Lord had done to Pharaoh and the Egyptians for Israel's sake, and about all the hardships they had met along the way and how the Lord had saved them. Jethro was delighted to hear about all the good things the Lord had done for Israel in rescuing them from the hand of the Egyptians. He said, "Praise be to the Lord who rescued you from the hand of the Egyptians and of Pharaoh, and who rescued the people from the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all other gods, for he did this to those who had treated Israel arrogantly." Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, brought a burnt offering and other sacrifices to God. And Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law in the presence of God. The next day, Moses took his seat to serve as a judge for the people, and they stood around him from morning till evening. When his father-in-law saw all that Moses was doing for the people, he said, "What is this you're doing for the people? Why do you alone sit as judge with all these people standing around you from morning till evening?" Moses answered, "Because the people come to me to seek God's will. Whenever they have a dispute, it is brought to me, and I decide between the parties and inform them of God's decrees and laws." Moses' father-in-law replied, "What you're doing is not good. You and these people who come to you will only wear yourselves out. The work is too heavy for you. You cannot handle it alone. Listen now to me, and I will give you some advice, and may God be with you. You must be the people's representative before God and bring their disputes to him. Teach them the decrees and laws and show them the way to live and the duties they are to perform, but select capable men from all the people, men who fear God, trustworthy men who hate dishonest gain, and appoint them as officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. Have them serve as judges for the people at all times, but have them bring every difficult case to you. The simple cases they can decide for themselves. That will make your load lighter because they will share it with you. If you do this and God so commands, you will be able to stand the strain and all these people will go home satisfied." Moses listened to his father-in-law and did everything he said. He chose capable men out of all Israel and made them leaders of the people, officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. They served as judges for the people at all times. The difficult cases they brought to Moses, but the simple ones they decided for themselves. Then Moses sent his father-in-law on his way, and Jethro returned to his own country. Please be seated. Well, we're in the Exodus story, and it's now 3 months after they left Egypt. Moses had been chosen by God to shoulder a unique workload. First, a titanic battle of wills with Pharaoh, ending in freedom of the slaves. And second, leading and caring for these refugee people in their very unusual journey to the promised land. Now, you have to remember that the usual way from Egypt to the promised land, to Palestine, was along what they called the Way of the Philistines. It was an established trade route along the coast, and it took about 2 or 3 weeks. And that was probably the route that Joseph and his brothers and father took, coming from the Canaan down to Egypt and back and forth. About 2 or 3 weeks. This journey so far had taken 3 months. And they'd turned off the main road long ago. In fact, did they ever get on it? God was leading them along what Exodus 13, verse 18 calls a roundabout way. To the people who had lived within one of the most civilized and prestigious nations on earth, albeit as slaves, but still they lived there, this journey was inconvenient, irrational, and seemingly directionless. And to make matters worse, they were piloted not by so much by the usual staging posts and mile markers, but by a strange and unpredictable supernatural phenomenon, a pillar of fire and cloud. They were pretty skeptical, even after the signs and wonders they had only recently observed in Egypt. And for Moses, this meant opposition, like fidgety kids in the back seat of a car. "Are we there yet? He's touching me. She's breathing on me." Chapter 14, they complained about the risk of dying at Pharaoh's hands before they crossed the Red Sea. Chapter 15, they complained about undrinkable water at Marah. Chapter 16, they complained about hunger in the wilderness of Sin. Chapter 17, they complained, quarreled, crabbed, griped, and moaned about no water at Marah, at Massah, and Meribah. It meant opposition to Moses, but that's not all. He faced opposition also from without. In chapter 17, a whole nation, a people group, came and attacked them, the Amalekites. So by the time we get to chapter 18, Moses was kind of a little bit wobbly on his feet. And the story of Meribah, this lack of water place, shows it clearly. Now, that story is told in two places. Once in Exodus chapter 17, which unfortunately we missed out on last week, but we'll catch up on in 5 seconds here. But it's also told in Numbers chapter 20, and there it shows this kind of wobbliness very clearly. The issue was no water. The Lord had instructed Moses to speak to the rock and to bring forth water. But instead of speaking to the rock, Moses verbally attacks the people. "Listen, you rebels, shall we bring water out of this rock for you?" And he strikes the rock, strikes it twice out of anger and lack of trust. And unfortunately for him, this slip-up cost him his entry into the promised land. The point is that despite his unique calling and equipping by God, Moses was experiencing a personal crisis. He'd become fragile, vulnerable, and at risk of burnout. He wasn't thinking very well. And this can happen to us too. No matter how skilled or trained or qualified or equipped we are for our roles, we can risk becoming fragile, vulnerable, and wearing out. I'm an American. I watched on TV the very first Super Bowl, which was 1967. And the coach of the very first Super Bowl champions, who were the Green Bay Packers, Vince Lombardi, said this: "Fatigue makes cowards of us all." You know, American gridiron players, pump the iron, so fatigue makes cowards of us all. And this is precisely what was happening to Moses. He needed relief and encouragement and care and companionship. And for some reason, his brother Aaron wasn't actually meeting his need. Moses needed someone else who could help him regain perspective, to reframe and retune his life. And he needed what the ancient Greeks called a mentor, and what the ancient Latins called a monitor. And fortunately for Moses, he had an outstanding father-in-law, Jethro. Let's look at Jethro. He was relationally close, but contextually kind of remote. Let me explain that. Relationally close, he was the father of Moses' wife. He was the grandfather and custodian, in fact, of Moses' children. He was Moses' former employer. So he was relationally close, but he was contextually kind of independent. He wasn't an Israelite. He was a Midianite from northern Saudi Arabia. He stood outside Moses' immediate context, and he was able to view Moses' life and movements and routines and decisions from the outside, objectively. He was also older, although that's not the important thing here, because Aaron, Moses' brother, was older, and he wasn't meeting the needs. So age isn't the most important thing, but this man, Jethro, was older. The crucial thing was that the way he cared in the following ways. He cared for Moses' family when required. Very practical. When Moses went on his mission to free the slaves, he sent his wife and his children back to their granddad. And Jethro cared for them. In verse 5, Jethro took the initiative to come and visit Moses. He took the initiative. In verse 8, he listened. And let's make this a punctuation mark. This is key. He listened to all that Moses was saying about what had happened. The benefits, the advantages, the disadvantages, the hardship. He listened to everything. Verse 9, he rejoiced in what the Lord had done, both for Moses as an individual and for the entire community of Israel. Verse 10 to 12, he blessed and affirmed and gave thanks to God, Yahweh, the Lord. And verse 12, he celebrated with Moses and the leaders in the most appropriate way of the time. He offered sacrifices, great big feast. So you include God, you include the people, and we're having a banquet. He did that. He also cared to hang around long enough to observe Moses' routines. He stuck around for a few days. He observed, verse 14, observed Moses' daily routines. Verse 14 as well, he asked some leading questions, some leading why questions. Verse 15 to 16, he listened some more. As Moses explained what the routines were. Well, they come to me for a decision. They seek God. He listened some more. And finally, and lastly, he offered caring and wise advice intended for the good not only of Moses, but for the whole community. Jethro cared. He listened. He added perspective. Sometimes we need this too, don't we? Have you ever been involved in such a relationship? Do you think you would like to be? Are there times in your life when you need someone to help you retune, reframe, stand back, get perspective? I do. Maybe you do too. Well, what to look for if you're going to find a relationship like this? Well, first, it's a pre-existing relationship. It pre-exists before the stress comes on. Moses met Jethro 40 years prior when he was a fugitive, remember? Long before the stress came on. Secondly, as we said before, someone who's relationally close, who cares, but who is maybe contextually a little bit removed, is helpful. Someone who can actually help you get off the playing field and kind of climb up into the balcony to look down, at least occasionally. You know? Sort of relationally close, contextually independent. Someone who can help you raise up, get up into the corporate box to have a look at the game. Importantly, you might want to include hospitality, which is what both of these two individuals did. Jethro, in Exodus chapter 2, he invites Moses in, have a meal, and he ended up staying with the family, getting married within the family, working for the family. But it started with hospitality. Don't minimize the effect of hospitality. And you see, Moses did the same thing to him, because when he expressed interest to come and see Moses, he said, I'm coming, come. And what does he do? He greets him, kisses him, bows down, humility, and he invites him into the tent. And there he tells him the story and all the other things that went on involved in inviting Jethro into the tent. They had a meal. They relaxed. Hospitality could be really important. There's mutual respect, as it says in chapter 18, verse 7. Moses bowed down and kissed him. They embraced each other and asked after each other's welfare. Listening, listening, listening is very important in a relationship like this. And it's also important to recognize and rejoice in what God's doing in the other person's life. After you listened, to give thanks to God and celebrate achievements. And sometimes to ask the important why questions. What were you thinking? You know? What were you thinking? Why are you doing that? Why is always the most important question, you realize. You can say how, but then someone might say, why is how the most important question? You might say what? what's the most important question, but someone else will come and say, well, why is what the important question, and so on. Why is always the most important? What are we doing here? Why are we here? What is our purpose? It's the most important question. So ask some leading why questions, and then listen some more. Listen some more. And then maybe, and finally, and potentially speaking and advising if required, but the trust and the care is there first. It's not your right to tell someone what to do, ever. You have to earn the right. So, you know, this is something to look for if we're looking for a relationship that's resourcing like this. Now, our pastors and elders are the natural people to look for to this sort of care. They both have the skills and the heart for it. But if they did this for all of us, and there's like a few of them, but not many really, when you look at the rest of us, if they did this for all of us, they'd end up like Moses, worn out, beaten up, overworked. And so be open to others besides pastors and elders if you're looking. Is age important? Well, it might be a little help, but I think maturity is more important than age. I've met some older people, none of them here, and I'm honest about that, who are about as mature as 10-year-olds. So age is kind of minor. Maturity is major. Some biblical examples of mentoring. Well, Jethro mentored Moses. Moses mentored Joshua. Samuel mentored David, Prophet Samuel, David. Elijah mentored Elisha. There was a lot of mentoring going on in the Old Testament. Now, was it restricted only to men? No. Naomi mentored Ruth in the book of Ruth, remember? Female, female. Well, what about, can women mentor men? Can men mentor women, vice versa? Well, you know the answer. Deborah, the judge, mentored Barak, the army commander, female, male. And Mordecai mentored Esther. So the answer is yes, given the right circumstance. I personally have an older female mentor who doesn't cover all my needs, but who's always been willing to engage in a theological conversation with me when others around couldn't care less. I like it. She likes it. We do that. And she's continually supplied me with books. I'm not a good reader, but I like reading and good books that are good for me. So I would consider her a mentor for me. So the answer is yes. In the New Testament, Jesus mentored Peter. Remember at the end of the Gospel of John, when he after the fish fire by the sea, and he takes Peter aside and says, "Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me?" That was Jesus mentoring Peter, wasn't he? And he'd done it at the Last Supper too, remember, before Peter denied him. But he was mentoring Peter, and he mentored the three, and he mentored the 12, and he mentored the wider group, including females, Martha and Mary. And then Peter mentored Mark. Mark's gospel was actually a helper. Mark was a helper and assistant of Peter as he went around and preached. That's why Mark's gospel is told from the perspective of Peter, because Peter gets a hard time in that gospel, because it's Peter himself reflecting on the things that he'd done wrong. So Peter mentored Mark, and then Paul mentored how many? Timothy, Barnabas, Mark, Silas, Luke. Those poor old Roman guards who guided him. So just about anything is possible for mentoring. The point is that mentoring is a biblical fact, and you might even say a God-given expectation, especially for leaders. Especially for leaders. And the main benefit is perspective. You know, the balcony. Moses needed a mentor, but that's not all. He also needed helpers. From verse 13 to 18, what were you thinking? Jethro says, What are you doing? What you're doing is not going to work. You're going to wear both yourself out and the people you're trying to help. It's not going to work. Listen to me. And he gives them some advice. He says, you need helpers, but you need to set it up properly first. The word we have for this these days in business circles is delegation. You need to set it up properly first. First, draw a frame around the picture for people. Put the task at hand into God's wider context. Why are we here? Why are we doing this? Teach them God's instructions for living. Show them the way they should go and the things that they should do. Instruct, guide, and direct. This is Jethro talking to Moses. So that they'll know in advance what the main aim is. Put a frame around the picture. Explain the why to them. And then pick helpers, but pick them carefully. It's kind of like the selection of elders and deacons in the New Testament that we read about. Pick them carefully. They must be people of ability, people who fear God, people who love the truth, people who hate dishonest gain. And another thing, try to match the level of ability, the responsibility, to the level of the ability of the person. Kind of nested helpers, thousands, hundreds, fifties, tens, kind of a military type platoon, company, regiment, division, whatever. Kind of like that. But the point was, you're going to match people's responsibility that you give them to their ability, to what they can. We don't want them being burned out, do you? So leaders, delegation does not consist of pulling rank on your underlings and throwing them the grubby work that you don't want to do. A lot of people in business think that's the thing to do. It's not. That's not good biblical delegation. It's not dropping them in it and running away. Your helpers need to know that they're not alone while they're doing the job. They're working under a delegated authority with backup support, accountable to a higher authority. They act on behalf of others. They must never feel that they're functioning alone. They, and you for that matter, leaders, are all part of one larger and more important act of service directed at those you're serving and eventually, ultimately, God himself. Delegation, biblical style. So what do we risk by working in isolation? Very easy. It's impractical and ineffective. It lacks objectivity. We don't ever get up on the balcony to look down. We're subject to overwork, discouragement, weariness, burnout, and tragically, most tragically, we can frustrate and even burn out the people we're trying to help. There's a saying in the cow cocky industry. I used to milk cows a little bit. When you start kicking the cows, it's time to get out of the shed. If we burn out, we can even hurt the people we're trying to help. No, that's a big risk in working in isolation. What do we gain by sharing the work out? We avoid burnout. Those we serve, they go home in peace. They get what they need. And third, and most importantly, others will actually be able to use their God-given gifts, skills, and talents. No one has it all. And it kind of reminds me of 1 Corinthians chapter 12, the body of Christ. Every single member is needed for the body to function properly. Katrina and I sometimes shop at Pack and Save. In fact, most of the time, Pack and Save is our go-to place. One time, not long ago, about a month ago, we went to get a trolley, and there were hardly any there. And we thought, oh, it feels like Good Friday, or you know, right? Everybody, all the trolleys are in the shop. It's going to be a horrendous getting around Pack and Save. We went in. It wasn't too bad at all. We got a trolley walking. When we came out, guess where the trolleys were? For some reason, have you ever been there when the trolley return staff happens to be sick? The car park was just full of these silver hazards, and people were backing out, trying to squeeze in places. It was horrendous. So you get a hazardous car park. You get inconvenienced and frustrated customers, and that's bad for business. Do we rate those staff highly. We had better. In a word, even the roles that appear to be insignificant are essential. And so it plays out in the body of Christ. And funny, this word that Jethro said in chapter 23, and so he gives him the instructions, and then he says, and so God commands you. That's pretty strong language. You've got to share it. Share it out. There's more at stake than just you and your reputation and your image and all that stuff. You've got to share it out. So let me just quickly finish. Paul Simon, he sang about relational pain, and he never, ever wanted to risk it again. He would say that it's preferable to live like a rock island. But there's another poet who lived slightly earlier in time, who used the same, very same language with a different conclusion. His name was John Donne, and he lived around 1600. And he wrote a poem that goes like this. No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less. As well as if a promontory were, as well as any manner of thine friends or of thine own were. Any man's death diminishes me, because I am involved in mankind. And therefore, never send to know for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. John Donne confirms that living like a rock island, it's not even possible, let alone preferable or desirable. That person cannot die without affecting you, is what he's saying. We are unavoidably interconnected, and there's actually not a lot you can do about it. The loss of one is a loss to all. There is no such thing as Buzz Lightyear, Star Commander. Remember him at the beginning of the Toy Story? He was guardian of the universe, right? There's no such thing. There's no such thing as lone standing heroes. Instead, we're all connected. We need each other. We need interaction. We need monitoring. We need assistance. We need fellowship. We need human warmth. And the sooner we realize this, the better our chances of living the way God wants us to live. And this, in fact, echoes what God himself says in the very first book of the Bible. It is not good for the man to be alone.